How does Google use design to create a world that lasts? This is the question I get the honor to be asking Katie Morgenroth, who is head of sustainable design at Google.
Design Perspectives, the podcast of the German Design Council. Today with Boris Mader.
Welcome to Design Perspectives. My name is Moritz Mader. Katie Morgenroth and I will be speaking about the sustainable aspects of hard and software of Google products and services. We'll be touching on circular business models and which ones are actually realistic for the tech giant. Plus, we'll touch on some societal debates and look into how these are impacting the Google design approach. Yeah, warm welcome on the early morning in California and the evening in Berlin to Katie. Super cool that you're joining us.
Thank you. Thank you. So happy to be here.
Maybe to hit things off with a question that doesn't come too deep from the big tech world, but is a little more personal. What drew you into circular design initially?
I mean, it wasn't really a path I expected to take when I first sort of started out in design. My parents are both from the art and design world. My father was an illustrator, my mother a UX designer. I think my grandparents actually had a pretty big impact on my early journey. My grandfather, he like led a huge innovation team at Kodak, which is a camera company, film company, and he developed like digital film on his team back in the 80s. And at the time, Kodak was making like all of their money on film and not really interested in moving to something that would like remove that source of revenue. And now we know like that's how everyone takes their photos. And that is just one example of how I think my wheel started to turn early on. It's like technology can make a huge impact on like how much waste is generated. It can change consumer behavior. It can be cool and exciting. And so if I sort of project that out many, many years down the road, I think I've kind of always sort of saw this space as like a system challenge, and like designers like really have an opportunity to influence a lot of change in a positive way. And so I think that's kind of been a thread that's been consistent in my career.
A very, very famous example and amazing to hear that it was your dad.
No, not my dad, my grandfather. My grandfather. My dad's amazing too. He's an illustrator and a woodworker.
Totally. That all the material and all the kilometers of film that Kodak had been producing actually not needed anymore as soon as you got a screen and the right digital recording technology. You also had a very impressive appearance on the Circular Design Summit, which is something, if our listeners have not heard it or seen it, you can find in the links below, of course. Also there, you spoke a lot about the role of a designer. And what really caught me as one of your quotes was that you see designers or like the evolving role as an orchestrator is what I took down, like more of enabling people and experts to come together. That's something I could very much relate to. And maybe looking back since the summit that was beginning early on this year, how has the conversation maybe evolved at Google?
Yes, that was an amazing summit. It was in April and we're here in September. So, I mean, a very big thing that happened is we launched a few new products. So we had our Pixel 2025 Pixel launch just a couple weeks ago. I think this year, a very big update for us was expanding our suite of products that offer repair. And so I was very much a part of that work stream. And I think we couldn't talk about it back in April, but the practice of sustainable design, circular design, has really evolved quite a bit over the last couple of years. We're really kind of thinking not only about how you interact with a product when everything's working well, but also how we sort of maintain its usefulness over a much longer life cycle through, over the years, of course, software and durability, but now through the lens of repair. So that's been a really big shift. We also launched a bunch of new environmental reports this year and took a more design-forward approach to their execution, which I was very close to. And I think when we think about the lens or the language or the mindset around sustainable design and circular design, I think it's so much about how we can sort of inspire people to come along on the journey and hold hands. And so I think those documents actually provide a very I think, inspiring look at like how we think about it through multiple lenses.
I remember that I wanted to catch you for a podcast directly after April and looking for times in the stuffed calendars, but also looking at topics back then. You said maybe we can speak a little like end of August.
Yeah.
And it seemed to already be hinting that the new Pixel family, the Pixel 10 series, which we...
It's an amazing series. It also is, the Pixel 10 series has the most recycled content of any Pixel phone generation yet. So there's been an incredible amount of work to just continue to scale recycled materials, which I forgot to mention. But yeah, I was busy back then, very busy also. So it's, yeah. I'm still busy, but you know, it's nice to sort of have these milestones, you know, a little bit in the rearview mirror, because it gives you a minute to take a breath.
Yeah, totally. I'm also very happy that we have so much to talk about already back during the summit. Also in the panel talk, we can also put in the links below. You spoke already so much about the collaboration of companies, like even across borders. And I thought that's so, you know, mature for a company to be so ecosystem driven and not to, you know, want to tackle everything on their own. And especially for a huge enterprise like Google, that really struck me as kind of like the new paradigm. Of thinking about design. And maybe really let's dive into the repairability. Maybe you could speak about the Google design approach on basis of those new repairability features.
Engineering our products to last, designing and engineering our products to last has been kind of a core tenet of the work that we've done for a while. Durability is a really big focus area, making sure that they can, you know, the products that we make can handle everyday drops, scratches, spills, like the basics. And we put our products through like a ton of reliability testing. We did this last year as well. We did a big photo shoot in our reliability lab, which is one of my favorite places to visit. It's like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. I mean, the amount of like crazy tests that products have to endure, it's pretty phenomenal to sort of see and experience.
Tell us something. If you can.
We do a lot of like water submersion tests where, you know, you're checking to make sure that everything is sealed and there's no bubbles popping out. We have some pretty cool pictures in our watch product environmental reports of some of like the freezing and thawing tests that we do to sort of understand like the boundaries of a product in various environments. There's, of course, drop tests, which are very fantastic to watch. But anyways, we take a lot of these pictures, we show them in these environmental reports. And
sorry, it just sparked so much in my head of like,
yeah,
fire and people trying to break them or something.
That's definitely what you do. You try to break them. But I think at design, like our area of expertise is try to like, how can we design our products thoughtfully so that they can pass those tests, and then, you know, work with our work partners in operations and engineering to, you know, solve for all of these high durability requirements, but also make them really elegant and beautiful. And the repair lens is a whole new space. We've been offering repair on our phones for a number of years. But this year, we were much more intentional about what was that internal design system that made the process of, you know, following through a repair feel more intuitive, reducing some of the steps it takes to sort of execute common repairs like battery replacement, which is really more about maintenance and like maintaining a high quality product for the long term. So we have like these little colorful touch points and tabs that help you know where to interact with the product from the inside out so that it's safe, as safe as possible. And then we also have like little things like high contrast screws that help you know like which ones are the ones you have to remove, just to sort of help guide wayfinding. And then of course, like we took a lot of care just to design the internals thoughtfully, very inspired by like the internals of watches and things like that, these high quality products that are intended to last a very long time, and really thinking about like how we can ensure that craftsmanship is on the inside of our products as much as the outside. I mean, this year the watch was added as a fully serviceable product, so display and battery can be serviced. And then our little earbuds, our Pixel 2a earbuds case also has a replaceable battery, and it is the absolute cutest. So really impressed and proud of the design team, and it was quite a journey. We're just scratching the surface of what we hope to do in the long term, and I think we're beginning that journey, which is exciting.
I imagine scratching the surface to be like an internal metaphor for working intensely on your product.
I didn't even think about that. Zing. Yeah.
I read an article already several years back. It's called Age of Average. Maybe you've heard it. It's gotten quite a lot of press that sort of like the exterior design or like the appearance of things starts to resemble so much across different companies. I recently checked it out for sanitary products that you have these lines, you know, some are square, some others are round, some are elegant, others are more extroverted. But in the end, you get pretty much everything from every company. So the next layer is the intelligence lying underneath, you know, like how do you take the screen off the watch? How fast can you access like a broken part that's inside, so that designers sort of leave this outer appearance with all its functionalities, rituals, and all this beauty it creates, but it gets more of a hygiene factor. And then to dive deeper, this is where emerging materials and all these amazing topics you must be on challenges designers like way more in this orchestrator role that you're describing. So maybe to put that into a question, like how does that push, you know, materials, production methods, and how do you kind of assess their potential?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I agree with you. I think the scope of responsibility for designers has deepened and expanded. And so it's definitely an exciting time because there's no shortage of problems to solve through creativity. For us, it's really important to start very early. I think we like to sort of start to rehearse the future and what possibilities we think might be held in a product many years before it ever launches. And we have a central sustainability team that sets a lot of like very specific like targets and metrics. And that really helps us sort of look a few years out to sort of understand, you know, where do we want to go? But then at a design level, we do a lot of visioning to sort of figure out, well, how do we put that into practice in a really inspiring way? We have a material science and engineering team that has a really, you know, robust roadmap of ideas on how we can continue to evolve our products to make them, you know, to incorporate as much recycled content as possible into enclosures and pieces like that. And then I think we're also working with our suppliers and our operations teams to figure out, well, at a component level, like how can we incorporate more recycled materials as well? So we're coming at it from a lot of different angles. I mean, I think at the end of the day, there's also just such a big part of the work that we do that's contextual. You know, I know for many years when we were working in the home space and working with larger products that just sit in space and you don't really touch them too often, we'd really think about, well, how can we eliminate coatings and, you know, incorporate as much recycled content as possible inside and out? We're getting much better at kind of benchmarking off of the previous generation. So we'll look at like, what did we do in the last generation and figure out, well, okay, where could we push the boundaries in this one? And often we'll kind of do some little experiments really early on that help us build confidence in like, what can we actually land, taking into account like all those durability factors I mentioned earlier, because we want to push the boundaries, but we also want to make sure we release a really quality product.
What is the most promising material or production method you currently are excited about?
We can't talk about anything that's not out there in the world, really.
Of course, yeah. I thought it's something like, you know, metal 3D printing or whatever, you know, something that feels a bit generic enough to talk about, but still specific coming from you.
This year, we had a big push of like the expansion of rare earth materials and cobalt, tin, recycled tin, recycled copper, recycled gold. I'd say this year I was quite excited to see the expansion of recycled materials at more of a component level. And this is not my core work. This is the core work of a lot of my counterparts who are incredible. But just seeing that you can like every single part is an opportunity for progress really inspired me. And I think an area we're actually doing a lot of work on materials is supply chain and is like supply chain packaging. We've worked really hard to sort of eliminate waste in places you don't even see. So like pivoting from, you know, foam dividers in bulk packaging to cardboard. And then last year we launched our 100% plastic-free packaging. That has continued this year. And aside from the enclosures of products, which of course, exciting to sort of think about material advancements there, I think the internals of our products and some of the less visible parts of the supply chain are where there's actually so much opportunity.
we're speaking about how Google uses design to create a world that lasts. I also really like the words you use to say rehearse the future. Why I repeat our main question is because I don't want to shift the focus too much with the question I'm about to ask you now, but I just have to. What is the role of AI in your processes of looking for things to save, also like shortcuts to take or identifying big data decisions within the supply chains or a myriad of other locations?
I mean, it is a very fun new tool to be using. And so we're experimenting with lots of the tools that Google is developing. I personally can say, like, I run a lot of very big workshops that help bring people together and speculate on new opportunities. I'm using AI quite a bit for the synthesis of those workshops, really making sure that I have an objective lens on like all the great ideas that come out of those so that I can share them back with our leaders and our teams. I've personally used them quite a bit for efficiency. And of course, there's new creative tools like Nano Banana, which are pretty fun to sort of experiment with when you're building things like mood boards. And I think through the AI and like sustainability lens, broader parts of Google have been doing really phenomenal things with developing ways to sort of predict the impacts of climate change or natural disasters, or thinking about how we can sort of offer people eco-routing options that helps reduce environmental impacts, and of course, energy savings and software efficiency and efficiency of our grids. Like AI, you know, is definitely finding its way into all of those layers. Those are not my core areas of expertise, but they are very inspiring. And I think like anything else, AI is a tool. Like it's something that can really, really help us, but it doesn't really replace the creative process, the role of designers, and like really being strategic and thoughtful about how we can design towards a more thoughtful future. But then using that to sort of help make our practice a bit more efficient.
It's also the question between, let's say, radical innovation and scalability in all the things you discuss, I guess, which is something where you need to, just get back to so many real people that have the actual experience. Yeah, maybe getting back to the example of the plastic prepackaging also, which is amazing. Like, didn't even know. And that also feels like if other companies would hear plastic-free, there would be millions of questions around, oh no, what happens, like, you know, something gets wet or other complex fields. I'm also thinking like one step further about the repairability features you mentioned. There's also so many new business models around refurbishment, leasing, and platforms. What is, say, realistic for Google?
I have to go back to your plastic-free packaging comment and just plug one little thing.
Yeah.
I think one of the areas that we care deeply about in the sustainable design space is advancing progress through sharing. So that pre-competitive collaboration, Google's issued a couple different guides that have sort of given a very, very detailed look at like how do we approach carbon conscious design, but also how did we land the 100% plastic free packaging. So if you are curious about that, you want to know more about the details, you can sort of download this extremely comprehensive guide. And that is intended to sort of help everyone across the industry learn from our progress, our mistakes, our landings. We think that's like one of the best ways we can all grow together is through sharing. And then to your comment about, you know, refurbishment and repair and business models.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that was so much the topic of the conversation we had in Stuttgart back in April, is like, what is the responsibility of a designer in enabling a circular economy?
Mm-hmm.
What is possible is also like so much dependent on what is the product? What does it enable? If we design a product so that it's easier to maintain, of course, you can take advantage of a lot more of business benefits. So software support was a big one for us, like enabling 7 years of software support on our Pixel devices back in 2023. It means like longer lasting software means you need longer lasting hardware. And can we also think about what is the business model for refurb? And then with repair, of course, there's the sale of things like spare parts and tools. And there's our authorized service provider network. And there's a business case there. And so we have a lot of different teams at Google who are looking at these different lenses so that we can like support a product and support our consumers through a much longer product lifespan. it's not for everyone, but I will say even a product that's built very well and is designed to last, it also means it would have a higher resale value. And so for folks who are interested in refreshing their devices, we can, get those devices back, our phones, for example, and then be able to sort of refresh them and get them back out there through those refurbished platforms. Those areas are very exciting too. I think you look at the luxury space, you look at Rimowa, for example, they just launched this recrafted line where they're taking back suitcases that have been around the world for decades, refreshing them with new hardware, and they're putting them out there again so that new consumers can buy them. And they're the coolest.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of examples of that happening in different adjacent industry spaces that are very inspiring. But yeah, it takes a lot of logistics complexity to take that on. But I hope that if we continue to sort of do the work that we're doing, those types of business models become more exciting.
Yeah, it's also, and again, not wanting to get too big, but it's very much a cultural perspective too, right? Like owning something new and without scratches, and trying to keep to avoid every scratch versus embracing the beauty of products that have been used a lot or have been touched a lot. Like Japanese culture, as one superficial example, has this entire tradition around things called nare, and N-A-R-E, which means the gloss of the hand, and I think every other language in the world would just call it grease or, something disgusting. And they just aestheticize it already via language. And thinking of cultural, in terms of all these business platforms and sharing models, I speak with many house owners, and coming from products around the building sector and closer to architecture. And owning something is such a big deal, right? House owners want to own. And I think people that use a phone might probably be the same. Right? This needs to be mine, and having the shift of what's on this is totally yours, but don't worry about the device, right? This can change as often as necessary or as you like.
Yeah, I think it is interesting to think about those models. There's a time-based aspect to it, though, too. Is it something that you use for a period of time and then it switches hands? Do you pass it down? And which products are you comfortable sharing versus owning and passing down? I think so much of this challenge is contextual, but you are correct that consumer behavior is one of the biggest challenges and opportunities. I'm part of a clothing rental service. So I try not to buy fast fashion. I try to only rent the things that I have sort of a time-based interest, and then have more of a permanent closet for other things. And I think that's something that is, I don't know, I'm kind of going off track here a little bit, but
it doesn't matter.
But I think there's a lot. All I'll say is I think there's a lot of adjacent industry inspirations, and even a car. When you own a car, you can bring it in for service appointments. You can keep it maintained. And if you go to buy a new car, you can get it certified refurbished, or you can buy the new one. And I think all of these different service models, they absolutely offer inspiration to the tech space. And I think now that technology is becoming longer lasting, those opportunities become more interesting for sure.
Yeah, and it's beyond cost saving, right? It's more of a circularity as a value, as a business value, which
for sure. And I mean, through the design lens, you go back to Dieter Rohm's 10 principles of good design, and good design should be long lasting, and it should be environmentally friendly. And so I think bringing it back to the design lens, it's really important as well.
How do you communicate that? Lifespan, repairability, responsible use, maybe also. I don't want to say educate, but now I have. what are your experiences in that? We always listen a lot as designers, try to understand people's behavior and expectations. But sometimes you have the golden opportunity to also, guide habits a little bit, maybe.
If you make something easy and approachable and you make it enjoyable, people will want to try it or do it. If you make it something that feels like a benefit and it's inspiring, I think it becomes an easier thing to market. I've talked about our environmental reports, but I'm very proud of the way that circular design shows up in those reports, because it reads more like a story. And we talk about why would you want to own something new versus something that's maybe been around the block. I think about furniture. I have a lot of vintage furniture in my home, and I care so much about the story. Like, why should I care? I want to know what this product's story is. And I think the more we kind of tell the story of how a product is made with care and craft and attention to detail, designed and engineered to last, made with recycled materials, showing what those are, like really at an ingredient level, it makes me care more. And maybe I'm biased because I'm very close to this, but I hope that, you know, knowing more about how these products are made and what they're made out of and the design intent behind them will create more value and an interest to hold on to them because it's something that you know more about and you value because of that story.
It might be very close to some societal debates also. You know, I recently heard that there's never been a time where there have been so little children and so few parents that they're marginally represented also in our democracy here in Germany, for example, and even are treated as a minority in some court rulings. You know, thinking of Gen Z values or post-growth mindsets, there's also already like a big expectation that resources should be treated carefully. And planet-centeredness may be more relevant than human-centeredness. And does that shape priorities in a way, or is it just going with the flow that Google had already been starting?
There are a lot of layers there. There are a lot of layers there. I think definitely planet-centeredness is very important. We have a pretty ambitious net zero commitment. We're working towards net zero emissions across all of our operations and value chain by 2030. And that is very much planet. That's like planet level gold. And then as far as like the first part of the question, I think was more around Gen Z and kind of the next generation. There's been a lot of documents and data that shows that they're the most like environmentally conscious generation yet. And that's very inspiring to me. And I think it's really what inspires me personally to do so much of the work in this space, because there's a proverb that says, we do not inherit the earth from our ancestors. We borrow it from our children. And I think everything we do is in this space is for that next generation, is to make sure that the same opportunities we've had and the joy of like experiencing nature is still there for them. And so at a very foundational level, that is definitely what inspires me. I have two boys, which we've talked about a little bit, and they're for sure one of my greatest sources of inspiration. And the more we can also fold curiosity in, like understand where people are in their journey of like kind of understanding the big picture and the opportunity, and not place shame on somebody who maybe is not as aware, but instead like start that conversation and meet them where they are and connect to what is valuable to them is really important.
That's maybe an excellent bridge or transition to the environmental report, the Google 2025 environmental report, that I wanted to ask you two or three things on before we close. Time is always so short and I want to ask you so many questions, but why I think it's a good bridge is because if we think about our children, you know, which have like a very limited span of attention, also need information prepared very accessible and very fast, I think then environmental report is something that, you know, is kind of following that expectation in many, many ways. I mean, it's very easy. I would even say entertaining to look at, although the main part of it is numbers. How did you approach this?
I will say that not only children have short attention spans, I myself have a very short attention span. I think we all do. We're living in such like an intense, fast-paced world. And to be able to like sit down and really digest data is quite hard. And I think in design, we know like a picture can explain 1,000 words. And so our environmental footprinting team, which is amazing, they've been doing these environmental reports for many years now. I think Google started their first in 2017 and provides a lot of really robust data. We've used that data in design for many years now to really help us sort of understand the composition of a product, which helps us understand where the biggest opportunities, helps us see where there's differences. Like a smart speaker has very different opportunities, like reduce energy, for example, than, you know, a phone, where like the greatest opportunities are in the production space. So we've been leveraging these documents internally, and then they're, of course, provided to everyone else to reference in the world around us for many years. You know, over the years, we've taken a little bit more care and attention to our documentation design. And given how many things we were excited to talk about this year, we thought, well, maybe we can evolve these documents and make them more useful for more people, for people who are just curious about what we're doing in the space of circularity and sustainability and design. And of course, like then people who are very deeply interested in the life cycle data of our products as well. We take a lot of photography. So since like 2017, we've been doing these really fun photo shoots every single year where we try to show more of our design process through pictures. And of course, the work that we do in the sustainability space is a big part of that. As I mentioned earlier, we've also done more site shoots where we're going into our reliability labs to show a more authentic peek at like what are the tests that we're doing to design for durability, who are the people behind the work. And we think that work is all very, very beautiful. And so we've used those assets at different moments in, you know, marketing materials and such, but we really thought it would be a great way to add more context to our pillars of, you know, engineering our products to last and designing with responsible material and advancing progress through sharing, which are our three main pillars. And we really explain more about our approach, which is this balance between art and science. Each product is different, and that's what makes them so unique. They're beautiful. The color stories are different. The way that each product is executed to sort of meet the context that it's intended to sort of live within is different. And so the tests, the reliability tests we put them through are different. And we thought it would be really fun to sort of show more of that. We are also quite proud of the percentage of recycled content that we are reaching in our products year over year. But each product may have, you know, it's been a decade of actually integrating recycled materials. And it started first with plastics and expanded into metals and like it's continued to expand into, you know, recycled cobalt, recycled tin, gold, copper, etc. Recycled aluminum is actually a really important one for our carbon story. We wanted to sort of talk more about that, to show that more at an ingredient level so that, again, similar to the guides I mentioned, maybe there's things that will inspire designers and who are coming up in this space when they see more of this work and see it at a more granular level, and then they can sort of put that into practice in their own way. Yeah, and it's just really fun. I mean, it's design work, it's collaboration, so it was a fun project.
Looking 5 years ahead, maybe, what are your biggest wishes for tech, design, circularity?
Oh, I mean, I think we talked a little bit about this again when we were together at the summit back in April, but I think expanding the definition of what a designer is really excites me. I think we're seeing a lot more of like the circular economy beginning to ramp up. We're seeing a lot more pre-competitive collaboration that's sort of helping to accelerate towards that. I mean, I do hope that 5 years from now, it's just fundamental that if you're exiting business school, you know how to build a circular business case, you know? And so I think those are the things that I'm excited about, is that we can take advantage of more of the design work that we're doing to sort of make things more thoughtfully designed from the inside out. And that we're able to, as we sort of put more of these systems in place, that we can also do more creative things, which, yeah, is the fun stuff.
One thought you'd like to leave with designers that are listening?
This quote may be cliche for many people, but who are close to this space, but it is said that 80% of a product's environmental footprint is established in the design phase of a product. And so if you are working in that space, whether you are an engineer, you're an operations lead, you're a product manager, a designer, like you have so much opportunity. And I think please reach out and grab that. Look at those challenges as opportunities and don't be so hard on yourself. Like we all want things to be perfect, but progress is really the most important part. And so just get started and ask questions and know that you have so much responsibility, which is the fun part. I will say one more thing though, that I would leave people with is have fun. Because if you're not having fun and if you're not keeping it fun, if you're somebody who's like leading these projects, it's hard to keep the momentum going because this is a crazy space and a lot of the things that we're doing haven't really been done before.
Yeah.
But if you can keep it loose and you can have fun, yeah, you're going to make so much more progress and you're going to create so much more momentum.
We spoke with the head of sustainable design at Google. I was very grateful to get a look into how Google uses design to create a world that lasts. And we took a deep dive into the Google approach of engineering products to last with intention and responsible materials as the art and science connecting and then advancing collective progress that Google does so beautifully by sharing and putting things out there. Plus, one thing that I especially take away from today is the circularity aspect of technology beyond hardware, thinking of the 7 years of software support and all those further amazing news you shared. So we got a lot to dive in within the links, and people can always contact us via LinkedIn. And I thank you very much, and I wish you a great day and us a good night or something if we'd be live, but evening
thank
here
you.
And a good day to you.
Thank you so much for the conversation and the time.
The Design Perspectives Podcast is a production of the German Design Council.